Good morning to Ed.
Good morning.
Our Bible reading taken from Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 13. Page 661. I have seen rebellious evil under the sun. Well called the arm of its owner. And then, Ecclesiastes chapter 6, verse 9. Better what the eye sees than the roving of the appetite. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the moon. This is the wrong way.
Keep your Bible open in Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Over these 4 weeks, we've looked at God as King. And as God's kingdom people, we are those who deal seriously with sin. We work at our worship. And of course, today we address the question of discouragement that comes from disappointment. I was going through some files recently, and I came across something that my mother had given to me. The question that she gave to me was simply a piece of parchment that said, "A tired soldier." I don't know who wrote it. I don't even know where it came from. But I did identify with it. "Lord, this soldier is tired. So very tired. He's worn to the bone from the battle. Never a ceasefire. So very tired. Nothing makes sense, Lord. Everything's so wrong. The battle he's fought has defeated him, but the battle is not over. Beyond the defeat, a ray of hope lies, faint, so very faint, but there, and the hope to go on and win. Lord, watch over the soldier. Pick him up. Brush him off. Show him your understanding and care. Bless the soldier, Lord, because he's me." If you're honest, that prayer, or one very much like it, has echoed through the corridors of your mind on more than one occasion. And sometimes the ray of hope that lies somewhere faintly on the horizon begins to fade, and at times disappear. That seems to be the case especially when we have disappointments. Someone or something has failed to fulfill our expectations. We've set our minds up in a way that anticipates a certain outcome, a certain response, but it doesn't come about. And so disappointment sets in, and when it does, we often feel defeated by the battle, as it were, and there's not much left inside that drives us on. The writing of the book of Ecclesiastes is from the pen of Solomon. And Solomon writes in the latter part of chapter 5 on into the early part of chapter 6. He talks about a number of situations that breed disappointment. And the result of that disappointment, the reactions that that disappointment then begins to engender. Fortunately, he moves beyond simply identifying the disappointments for us, and he weaves quietly into the text the solution for the disappointments in general. Before you look at the solution, the good news, sometimes you must address the bad. Has been characteristic of Solomon's approach throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, he comes to another aspect of human existence. He talks about the subject initially of wealth, and he seeks to find out, if possible, that there might be discovered a clue to it all. But he meets disappointment. Look at verse 13 through 16 of chapter 5. He talks about the disappointment of financial reversal. Solomon is a wealthy man. And he begins with a series of observations on wealth. He thinks that if he knows anything, it must have something to do with what he possesses. He knows the power of and the limitations of wealth. He says in verse 10, 11, and 12 that money, things, never satisfy. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, he says, nor he who loves abundance with his income. This too is vanity. So vanity is one of his important words of the whole book of Ecclesiastes. He says, in some ways, wealth is parasitic on itself. It brings all kinds of friends out of the woodwork. It's physically destructive. And all enjoyment of what one has is clouded by what one does not have. And all gratitude for the present blessing is far overshadowed by the fears of tomorrow's losses. It leads into what he says in verse 13. There is a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun. Riches being hoarded by their owner to his hurt. When those riches were lost through a bad investment, and he had fathered a son, then there was nothing to support him. That's why Solomon introduces the subject with the words, there is a grievous evil. In the passage beginning in verse 13, it will not be the first time, nor the last time, that he simply uses this expression. The term grievous, it means something which is extremely painful, something that causes anguish. In other words, what Solomon is talking about is not simply ordinary evil, but it is something that causes deep pain and tremendous hurt in a person. Now then, what created that pain, that disappointment? The illustration he uses regarding this grievous evil is financial reversal. We're introduced in this passage to a father who loses all his money at a single blow. And the result is he leaves not only himself, but his whole family destitute. He's worked long and he's worked hard in business. He saved everything he could in an effort to set up his family. And then for some unexplained reason, he makes a poor investment. And that investment decision results in him waking up the next morning and he is totally broke. It would be easier to understand that had this been the result of a penalty for business dealings that were under the table, or because he had hoarded his money for himself only. The idea to neglect other people or it suffers loss as a result of gambling. But in fact, it says it's an honest money that has turned sour. And the result is disappointment. You can feel for this man because you know the pain of financial reversal. You've seen it in yourself or you've seen it in others. And of course, you've seen things that have gone up in smoke. Others have found yourselves among the ranks of unemployed. And the image of unemployment, where so much of our identity is often determined by the job we participate in, unemployment can create whole other issues, not simply loss of money, but the questions of identity. You poured money into a home. You hope to make a profit, only to find out you poured too much into it, and then the market has turned sour. You understand how it is. You own a car, having no problems with the car until it begins, and all of a sudden then you begin to rent a room at the garage because you're there on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis. Perhaps some of you put money into investments and they were guaranteed, only hoping to collect, and of course the quick turnaround doesn't work and the bottom falls out. I came across the words of a woman recently who said that for 22 years I built a business. I married a man and brought him in. I became vice president, made him president. A few years later, we got involved in divorce litigation, and he brought in a sharp lawyer, and we transferred all of our assets and liabilities into a new corporation. And suddenly, I was out. And of course, I found out that everything I had built, there was nothing to show for 30 years of labor. So you listen to the words of people, and you recognize that such disappointments are real. They are things that are actually happening in people's lives. What happens when you do or are confronted by grievous disappointment? If your money, your income is your foundation for life, if it is what you live for, if it is your only security, and of course the only result is increasing pessimism and cynicism that comes to life. He says in verse 15, as he had come naked from his mother's womb, so he returns as he came. He takes nothing from the fruit of his labor that he can carry in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Exactly as a person is born, thus will he die. So what is the advantage to him who toils for the wind? A grievous evil. He's been disappointed because of the loss of what he had lived for. And of course, the man despairs of life itself. He adopts the mindset of the pessimist. He gives up. It's kind of like a plague. People today who live only for their accumulated wealth, however much or little that may be, for whatever purpose it may be directed, if and when that wealth is threatened, their disappointment turns to cynicism and pessimism. The Old Testament scholar Derek Kidner says, if anything is worse than the addiction money brings, it is the emptiness that it leaves. He says, humanity with eternity in its heart needs better nourishment than that. It was Dr. E.E. David, Jr., a former presidential advisor on science and a former president of the National Association for the Advancement of Science. He was also part of the role that within Exxon Valdez research and, of course, the engineering corporation that goes along with it. He spoke candidly to a group of engineers on one occasion, and he said this: "It is not essentially inflation. It's not essentially inflation. It is not the lack of savings. It is not essentially the lack of capital investment or the quality of our production. The essential reason for the decline in Western industry is the national shift to pessimism." It's what occurs when an economy turns sour. It's what occurs when people's lives are threatened. It's what occurs because of the rapid succession of social media to make it instantaneous to every one of our ears. He talks about the disappointment that comes because of financial reversal. I want you to look at verse 17. Verse 17, he gives you the disappointment of physical illness. He said, "Throughout his life, he also eats in darkness with great vexation, sickness, and anger." The person Solomon describes is living out a depressed life. That's the idea behind the phrase, "he eats in darkness." His perspective has become clouded because of physical illness that he is not able to deal with. And the physical illness may be because of the consumption of wealth or even the loss of wealth. So one might lead into the other, absolutely. But he says there are physical repercussions nevertheless. I want you to notice the specific cycle of emotions that Solomon outlines in his verse. He's talking about a person whose perspective or security is tied up with good health. In the first situation, the individual found security in wealth, and when it disappeared, he became pessimistic. This person is a little bit different. Wealth is not his first concern, but health clearly is. Now, we're all concerned about health. But of course, this person's world revolves around not being sick. That kind of dream standard causes him to suffer what Solomon uses here as the word vexation. The root meaning of the word is to agitate, to stir up the heart. In other words, this man is uptight. Picture a person who's not even yet sick, but either he has developed symptoms that lead him to believe that he is developing something, or he's preoccupied with staying healthy, that this anticipating stress results in agitation. There are thousands of people today who fit into that mold. As long as we are healthy, we seem fairly together. But if anything begins to strike us in terms of physical health, then we fall apart. You see, the basis of our security, our definition of security, is being attacked. That's why there's been such an incredible surge in vitamin consumption and exercise and health. How many of you have your Fitbit on? And make sure you're doing your 10,000 steps a day. I simply do this to make sure that it still works. It comes regardless. Sickness is relentless. When it causes long-term adjustments to our lifestyle, Solomon says in verse 17, we become angry. The word anger has a couple of shades of meaning. The first is related to being afraid, obviously. We get angry at the sickness, at the doctors who can't cure us, at our God for not healing us, and the basis is fear. I think of a friend of mine who watched his father suffer from Alzheimer's. It began slowly with the memory lapses, the confusions, the decreased mental capacity, and ultimately reduced his father to a semi-vegetative state. He said to me this. He said, "You look inside your mind that see nothing but black." My friend said that the heartbreak of the disease is not only is it untreatable, but it is also difficult to diagnose. That is hard to deal with. My friend said that his greatest guilt came when he had to institutionalize a person he revered and he had honored all of his life. He reflected this way: "Maybe it isn't guilt I fear, it is heartbreak." We are fearful of that. The second shade of meaning in this word anger comes from Arabic root, which means to break or to snap off. When you realize you're helpless to the ravages of disease, very often you snap. We're angry because we can't control the illness that threatens to destroy us. Now, all of these reactions, whether it be a clouded perspective, agitation, fear, or anger, are the understandable human responses to the disappointment of physical illness. We experience them. We all do. However, they're not to be our only response, or God forbid, our final one. You see, if your security depends on your health, and your health is threatened, you will, unless you have outside assistance, remain agitated, fearful, and angry over the disappointment that results. Someone has said that faith plants the flag of reality in the fortress of our own heart. Another commented this way, pain reduces us to the primary level, the level of dependence upon our God. While we stretch our full length on Him, everything within us that is useless and abrasive simply melts away. Those who were hard and harsh are humbled in Him. Those once proud and self-sufficient are drawn to their knees. That doesn't happen if health is more important to you than God. So we grow disappointed over financial reversal, over physical illness. But I want you to look at the first few words of chapter 6. There's also the disappointment of discontent. He said in verses 1, 2, and 3, there's an evil. He's already used grievous evil twice, and he says, there's an evil which I have seen under the sun. It's prevalent among people. A person to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor so that his soul lacks nothing of all the desire, yet God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. This is vanity and severe affliction. If a person follows 100 children and lives many years, however many they may be, but his soul is not satisfied with good things, and he does not even have a proper burial, then I say, better the miscarriage than he. You look at the individual in these verses. He also, in some ways, is dealing with financial issues, but now of a different kind. He hasn't lost anything. In fact, just the opposite occurred. You have an individual who seems to have had the Midas touch through his life. Everything has turned to gold. But you notice verse 2 says there is conflict. The phrase there that God has not empowered him to eat from them carries the idea of that God has not given him the ability to enjoy the possessions he has accumulated. When you're a university student and you're hungry, you look for hamburger and hamburger helper. When you're old, rich, and successful, and you're able to afford steak, your stomach can't handle it. This man has experienced a long spell of sunshine in his life. He's walking on a cloud. There's an adverb to that. And yet, despite all of that, he does not have any kind of contentment. No matter what he accumulates, no matter how much he accumulates, there is no inner satisfaction. The word in verse 3 that is said there, his soul is not satisfied, it means to have one's fill. Here's somebody who possesses everything that is meaningful in Old Testament thinking. Wealth, honor, numerous children, long life, virtually every outward good that anyone could possibly imagine. Yet he's broken, he's dissatisfied, he's unhappy. And what is worse is that he is still grasping for more. With every additional asset, he wallows in disappointment. Dr. David Rubin, who makes no claim to being a Christian, puts his finger on the pulse of the problem in one of his books. Dr. Rubin said, in the so-called modern society, there's a constant external pressure to acquire things. Not just a car you need, it's the ultimate in cars. A suit, a pair of shoes is not enough. You need the latest style in everything. What was in last year is out this year. There's the in neighborhood, the in country club, the in restaurants, and even the in cigarette, if you can believe it. You're trained to believe, just like Pavlov's dog, by conditioned reflex, you must constantly discard your current material possession in favor of newer and more exciting ones. In a real sense, you start observing everyone else through an immense magnifying glass and looking at ourselves through the wrong end of the telescope. What other people have, what they do, and what they accomplish all look bigger than life. With that kind of frame of reference, when our own self-worth is determined by what we own in comparison with others, there is discontentment. In fact, if you look at it, he says it's so disappointed that that type of person becomes with their lot that they often think and sometimes voice the lament of Solomon. Verse 3 again, he says, if a man fathers 100 children, who lives many years, however many they may be, but his soul is not satisfied with good things, and he does not even have a proper burial, then I say, you notice how harsh this is? Better the miscarriage than he. And then verse 4, for it comes in futility and goes into obscurity, and its name is covered in obscurity. Life has become for this person a cruel twist of fate. You feel like a greyhound on the track, always running after the elusive rabbit that you never catch. You're never able to reach it, to hold it in your hand. Now look at verse 7, 8, and 9. In verse 7, 8, and 9, he talks about the disappointment of unfulfilled goals. Solomon introduces us to this in verse 7. He says, all a person's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not satisfied. Now here's a verse that makes a point that is painfully up to date. We work to eat, for the strength to go on working in order to be able to eat. Now that can be frustrating. But then when to that you add the reality of unfulfilled dreams and disappointment is about to pounce. He says in verse 9, what the eyes see is better than what the soul desires. This too is futility or vanity, striving after a win. All of us have dreams. We have dreams about families and careers and lifestyles and futures, hopes and expectations. Sometimes they motivate us. They enthuse us. But if a person's security depends upon their dreams, they'll find them terribly disillusioned. Why? Because dreams don't always come true. Many people are living today in a fantasy world of what ifs. They're waiting for their lottery ticket to be a big winner. They're waiting for the big break, the sudden recognition. This week I was standing in line to find an older gentleman, a guy that I've known for many years, and Nick is 93. And he had an infinite number of transactions. I was going to buy the paper. So finally I said, Nick, would you hurry up? Now what was he doing? 93. He was buying lottery tickets because he wanted to win the big one. I said, if you don't get in line here, you're going to have a big one. And just a bit. But of course, dreams often strangle people. They become immobilized in the present in their preoccupation with their dreams of future. Someone wisely said, shoot for the ideal, but accept the real. Yet many of us are self-programmed to rather dream about the impossible rather than attempt what is real. Someone said, we need to take an honest look at our habit. One thing that inevitably leads to disappointments are expectations. We erect mental images or dreams that are either unrealistic or unfair. Those images become our inner focus, rigidly and traditionally maintained, leaving no room for flexibility. We set in mental concrete the way things must go. When we don't, we either tumble or grumble or both. The result is tragic. We need to give ourselves a stretching room. This will mean we stop anticipating the ideal and start living the real, which is always checked with failure, imperfection, and even wrong. You see, if you do not do so and insist on leaving out unrealistic dreams, you find yourselves concluding with the word of Solomon at the end of verse 9, which says, this too is vanity. And a striving after win. Life will remain disappointing, empty, like beating your head against the wall and accomplish nothing. You'll agree with Shakespeare and Macbeth, who described life as a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Now, if you've come to this point in the message and you're still awake, you'll appreciate the fact that anything I've said to you so far, you could have got from Psychology 101 class or an introductory psychology book. You might have even heard some of these comments from some cynic on the subway on the way to work this past week. But is there anything to say beyond this? If we assess the problem, is there a solution? He says the solution to discouragement is given to us. A couple of verses that I quickly jump over. back to chapter 5, verse 18. He says in these verses, "Here is what I have seen to be good and fitting." Now, to eat, to drink, and to enjoy oneself in all of one's labor. Now, of course, at that point you say, "Hold on a second. Are you saying that the Epicurean philosophy to eat, drink, and be merry is the solution?" Keep on going. He says, "In one's own labor, in which he toils under the sun during the few years of his life which God has given him. But this is his reward. Furthermore, as for every person to whom God has given riches and wealth, he has also empowered him to eat from them and to receive his reward and to rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. For he will not often consider the years of his life, because God keeps him occupied with the gladness of his heart." Psychology 101 will tell you about the nature of discouragement and disappointment. But four times in those verses is the key word, no. The disappointment of our passage is open to us today in all likelihood a part of Solomon's own midlife crisis. He's wandering aimlessly. He's a treadmill spinning from one experience to another. Solomon is moving from impulse to stimulus, all in pursuit of satisfaction. But it never came until he found the real solution to his disappointment in life. The key word is God. It has been glaringly missing in everything he looked at so far. But when it is time for a solution, God appears. And inseparably linked with his presence, you're going to find words like this. You notice verse 18? Good. Fitting. Look at verse 19. Reward. Rejoicing. Look at verse 20. Gladness of heart. The secret of disappointments which inevitably come in life is not to hope for no more disappointments. It's not to ask for deliverance from disappointments. The solution to disappointments is an openness to God. A readiness to take what comes in our life, understand heaven's permission, and offer in these things thanksgiving to God. You see, the capacity to enjoy, no matter how great or how small, is a gift from God. Enjoyment comes by knowing the living God and taking everything from his hand with thanksgiving. In the context of pain or pleasure, with thanksgiving. That's the gift of God. That's the only thing that confronted Solomon's vanity. A person who places their trust in God can enjoy the ordinary things of life. They'll always be grateful to the Lord no matter how much or how little they have, because their security is in the Lord. Not in their investments, not in their health, not in their possessions, not in their unfulfilled dreams. Someone has well said that good life exists only when you stop wanting a better one and savoring what is rather than longing for what might. People discover the richness of life which God has provided. They do not think of the past or even talk about it. They do not talk about the future either in some pining fashion, because it's so richly involved with the savor of life right now. How good it is to know the living God, to know that he controls what comes into our lives. He expects you to make choices absolutely. Scripture encourages us to do that well. More importantly, to learn to rejoice in the wisdom of the Father's heart, to richly enjoy what is handed day by day, and that's the secret of disappointment. It is the secret to life. What message have you for young people? That was the question that Carl Stern of NBC a number of years ago, in a concluding television interview with Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. Heschel died shortly after the interview. And of course, Rabbi Heschel replied this. He said, "Let them remember that there is meaning beyond absurdity. Let them be sure that every deed counts, that every word has power, and that we all can do our share to redeem the world in spite of all the absurdities and all frustrations and all disappointments." And above all, he said, "Let them remember to build a life as if it were." There's one way to conclude this morning, and it's the prayer that is offered in the wisdom literature of the book of Proverbs. It's not the words of Solomon, it's the word of Agar. And Agar speaks in Proverbs 30, verses 7, 8, and 9, says this, "Two things I ask of you. Do not refuse me before I die. Keep deception and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is my portion, that I not be full and deny you, and say, 'Who is the Lord?' Or that I not be in want and steal and profane